Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte. Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, we had a busy news week this week, and it's not over yet. One of the issues grabbing headlines is what two court rulings in Washington, D.C. could do to Obamacare. Joining us right now in the studio, Laura Wides-Munoz of the Associated Press. Laura, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
On the phone line, we've got Mary Shedden with Health News Florida at our partner station WUSF in Tampa. Where are you, Mary?
Good afternoon, Christine.
Hey, and Sammy Mack, who covers healthcare policy for WLRN. She's on Skype. Sammy.
Hey, Christine.
Hey. Now, it's your show, too, so please call us. The number to call is 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet throughout our show. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN. Health insurance subsidies under Obamacare are on very shaky ground for the nearly 1 million Floridians who need help buying insurance. One federal appeals court this week ruled the subsidies can only be handed out in states that run their own insurance exchanges. Just hours later, a different court ruled the complete opposite. Laura Wides-Munoz, help us unpack all this. First of all, a little Obamacare primer. How is a state-run exchange different from a federally run exchange?
Well, you kind of said it right there. It's run through the state. So the states are handling it. And Florida and I believe 35 other states have opted not to create their own. And so people who live in Florida, low income, who are looking for health insurance that could be subsidized are going to go to the federal government's website and sign up there.
Mary Shedden, what is at stake here?
Well, you're talking about a lot of money in Florida and across the country. As Laura said, there are 36 states that have this. $36 billion this year in subsidies went out, about $4.6 billion in Florida alone. What that means is that individuals won't be able to pay their monthly premiums, and they may have to give up their health insurance if this court ruling does pan out.
And this is for anybody who cares to answer. How did these two courts arrive at such dramatically different rulings? Laura, how did that happen?
Different judges. I mean, what's interesting, I'm not an expert on the details of the case. I do believe it's not retroactive, though. So just to clarify, it may be in terms of who can sign up in the future or if you resign.
Right.
But one thing that's interesting is that in each case, I believe, at least these two cases in Virginia and in Washington, it's the same lawyers who are bringing the case on behalf. So clearly it's an orchestrated effort to...
And there are two more in the pipeline as
right.
well. And part of what happened is the D.C. panel basically looked at it and said, listen, in the language that we're looking at in this law, it specifically says the state exchanges. And in the Virginia panel, what they said is, well, the intent was that it would be all of the exchanges run by the states. We didn't know what was going to happen, but the intent was there. So it's a bit of a semantic argument, and it's part of the approach for taking down and kind of dismantling the Affordable Care Act piece by piece.
Okay, so...
Right, one...
Oh,
I'm sorry,
ahead, Laura.
One of the things,
Mary.
One of the things that the D.C. court said is they even admitted in their literal interpretation of the law, they said, while we know it's going to have a potential significant impact on individuals, it's not their job to write the law. It's Congress's job.
In other words, one ruling, anyone can correct me if I'm wrong here. One ruling seems to be looking at the letter of the law. The other is looking at the intent, the spirit of the law. Am I wrong?
That's right.
Exactly.
And professors, law professors tend to say that if the spirit of the law, if looking at the letter of the law creates a situation that is pretty absurd, as in suddenly, millions of people being without what the law was intended to do, that generally speaking, the idea is to go with the intent of the law. But there have been cases either way. So.
Okay, and we've got a caller on the line. This is Gary calling in from Fort Lauderdale. Gary, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I can't understand why a political party could think that they can benefit from taking people's health care away from them. Can you explain that to me?
Okay, first, Gary, let us know which political party you're talking about.
Well, it would obviously be the Republican Party. They're the ones that are against health care for people.
Okay, Gary, thank you.
I wouldn't presume to speak ever for any party, but I do think, A, they're just people who think the law is bad and want it done away with. And B, I would think there are people, especially in Florida, which is a swing state, and other states that would like to see an effort by the Obama administration not work out. And so any repeal of one of the major signature measures of the administration would be a win for those who politically oppose. But I think there are also people who definitely simply think this is a bad move for the U.S. and they're going to fight it tooth and nail.
But Gary has a point. I mean, it is a hugely significant political issue. And right here in Florida, especially because we've got this gubernatorial race that is fast becoming nasty. So what does this mean for the governor's race at this point?
It'll be really interesting to watch this one because on the one hand, as Laura pointed out, there's some political advantage for the Republican Party to see part of this fail. But on the other hand, nobody wants to be responsible for the nearly 1 million Floridians who get the subsidies to lose those subsidies. So it's going to be a really, really delicate balancing act to see kind of how the politicians align themselves or not and message it and kind of frame it. It's going to be really interesting to watch.
And
the other thing too is that this isn't going to happen. I mean, if the subsidies are taken away ultimately, which we are a long way away from that decision, it's not going to happen for at least another year and a half. So people won't feel it in their wallets during election season.
That's a really good point. And then I think the other thing that's interesting in terms of the balancing act that you mentioned is, you know, Governor Scott is opposed to the exchanges in the state, but yet he wants to expand the Medicaid. And, you know, that's asking the government for more money to cover low-income folks that, you know, now as a result of this kind of appeal could be taken away from them on the other end.
Thank you, Laura. And you can join the conversation. Please call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. Once again, 800-743-9576. Or you can send us a tweet. The call sign is at WLRN. And another big health story this week. A Florida court awarded a Pensacola widow more than $23 billion. This was from the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. Cynthia Robinson's husband started smoking when he was about 13 years old. He died of lung cancer at the age of 36. Robinson sued the cigarette maker for hiding the harmful effects of its products. Now, there have been lawsuits against tobacco companies dating back to the 1950s. I mean, just around the time that I do believe the Surgeon General started issuing those warnings. Okay. But when it comes to class action lawsuits, plaintiffs in the state of Florida were sort of at the vanguard.
Well, this is not my specific area since I cover immigration and U.S. health, but I think that one interesting thing that you have to look at when it comes to this case, unfortunately, is at the end of the day, I think cigarette company stocks dropped about 1%. Reynolds dropped 1% after this massive, massive settlement. So to keep in mind, this is cost of doing business still for them.
Right. And the whole issue of the class action lawsuits, I mean, in Florida, it's unique because there's this one case based out of Miami, a pediatrician named Howard Engel. Back in the 90s, he was the lead plaintiff. There were 700,000 smokers who filed as part of this lawsuit. And what you're seeing is this case and dozens of others across the state are pieces of what's fallen out from that class action suit, because the Florida Supreme Court ruled that each individual had to sue. And this latest ruling is an enormous, enormous finding on behalf of the plaintiffs. But what it'll mean down the road, we're not sure. Just expect to see hundreds, if not thousands, of more lawsuits just like this.
And Sammy, how has Florida's history with these tobacco lawsuits impacted the rest of the country?
This is actually a really fascinating story. So in 1997, Florida was, I believe, the second state to settle with the tobacco companies in a lawsuit that was claiming that that the tobacco companies basically owed the state money for the cost of caring for people in Medicaid who had suffered from tobacco-related diseases. And so what ended up happening is they got several billion dollars in this settlement, and they used a huge chunk of it, and especially in the beginning, they used like $78 million for public health prevention campaigns, which that kind of money never happens in public health. And what they ended up doing is creating what you guys might remember as the Truth Campaign, which was this really aggressive marketing campaign that also used peer-to-peer kind of messaging between teenagers to get teenagers to not smoke.
Those ads were very, very graphic, if I recall.
Yeah, and they involved, you know, like body bags outside the tobacco companies. Yep. And part of the interesting backstory here is that they had the money to do really good market research and found that, surprise, surprise, teenagers, if you tell them don't smoke, you'll die, that doesn't really sink in because teenagers think they're going to live forever. But what they did find is that teenagers hate feeling manipulated, right? So what they did instead was create the series of campaigns that showed them the many ways, based on documents that they had found, that they were being marketed to, and kind of created this sort of framework that made them feel like they were being manipulated by the tobacco companies. And it worked really well. In that first year, there was a drop of smoking rates among middle schoolers that was like 20%. But again, like, those numbers are unheard of.
So it is working. These anti-tobacco campaigns are working. We have evidence. We have studies, independent studies.
Yeah, and the Florida model is now held up by the rest of the country for all sorts of different kinds of public health campaigns and approaches. And it was the first time anybody had really done something that big and aggressive and kind of sideways. Some of the ads didn't even tell you not to smoke.
Thank you, Sammy Mack. She covers healthcare policy for WLRN. Thanks also to Mary Shedd in Health News Florida at our partner station WUSF in Tampa. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Still to come, we hear about a growing national crisis, unaccompanied children and teenagers entering the United States illegally, and how this affects Florida. Later on in the show, sea level rise and climate change are causing trouble from Miami Beach to Tallahassee. That's up, coming up shortly on the Florida Roundup. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Right now, the United States is dealing with a humanitarian crisis revolving around the growing number of immigrant children and teenagers crossing the U.S.-Mexico border illegally into the United States. And right now, we'll be discussing how that affects Florida. Back in the studio with us again, welcome back, Laura Weitz-Munoz from the Associated Press. And just joining us now, Al Shardy from El Nuevo Herald. Al, good to see you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald. Jackie, good to have you back in here again.
Thanks for having me.
And just a reminder that our listeners' questions and comments are a huge part of the Florida Roundup. We need to hear from you, so please, that number to call is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can send us a tweet as well, at WLRN. Laura, these kids, how many of them are there? At least let's take it from perhaps maybe October to now. How many have come in from Central America?
We're now talking about more than 57,000. I heard today on the radio 70,000. I don't know if that's a little high. In Florida alone, the government has released numbers that more, just since January, more than, 3,000, nearly 200 have been released to people, you know, relatives, friends, sponsors. And, you know, interestingly enough, that's higher than California, the number that are going to California. Florida's got a very large number, lower than Texas, about on par with New York. So this is significant. Now, kids have been coming here and being in our shelters for years from the border. That's nothing new, although the governor's office appeared somewhat unaware of this earlier, I guess, last week. But in Florida alone, you know, the numbers have doubled, basically, in the last year.
Doubled in the last year, mostly from Honduras. You correct me if I'm wrong. El Salvador and
Guatemala.
Why now, Al? Why this influx, this flood of kids now?
I don't think it's a sudden surge. My the way that I look at it, it started a while back. Up until, I think, 2011, the average number of unaccompanied children crossing the border was about 6,800. And then this report by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops says that beginning in 2011, that's when it jumped. It jumped to 13,000. And then in 2012, fiscal year, it jumped to 24,000. And the report, compiled from U.S. government figures, said that they expected 60,000. I think the surge has been going on for at least 2 or 3 years. And the genesis of it is, I guess, various factors, but the consensus seems to be increasing criminal violence by organized criminal gangs in those countries.
Now, Al, you've talked to some of these kids. What have they told you about what they experienced during that crossing over from at the border?
Right. The children that I've talked to, which is like maybe a dozen or so since March, they essentially have the same story. They didn't come by themselves. They didn't come with their parents, but they came either with adult migrant smugglers mm-hmm. or adult relatives or adult friends who were leading a group of children, usually teenagers and in some cases some toddlers taken care of by the teenagers. And that's how they crossed the border in clusters. And they moved, at least the children that I talked to, the teenagers that I talked to, they moved in groups in cars or buses, sometimes walking, but not walking the whole
right.
trip.
And we often say unaccompanied, but, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is they are accompanied by some very, very bad people. And
I would just say they're not, I mean, we can discuss whether this is an ethical business or not, but from the folks I've talked to, often the coyotes are just doing their job and making sure the kids get there safely. And often these kids are now riding in private buses, and every step of the way they are paying off the governments of these countries. You cannot ignore that these kids are not fleeing through the night. It's bad business. If every group you bring across dies in the middle of the desert, nobody's going to use you. So most of these coyotes, if you pay up for the cost of transporting your people, are not actually trying to hurt these kids. So not to give them a good name, but just say this is a business.
But there is the tragic other side to this story. And here we have that other side told by Anna. She was a 17-year-old from Honduras. She describes what happened when she lost the rest of her group. She suddenly finds herself in a cottage somewhere in Mexico. She describes what happened next, and it's obviously very, very difficult for her to recount this.
Recuerdo que ellos me decían, cállate.
I remember they kept telling me to shut up. They would cover my mouth and they would tell me to shut up. If you don't keep quiet, we're going to kill you right here. Your life will end here. I was shaking and didn't know what to do. The only thing I kept thinking was that I was going to die.
Al, Miami is one of 10 cities where kids and teens like Anna are being sent after they cross the border. So first, let's cover what are the 9 other cities?
Well, I don't have the comprehensive list with me, but it's New York is included, Los Angeles, Chicago, the main urban centers in the United States.
Okay, and for the kids who get to Florida, I mean, who's bringing them here? How do they get here?
I think there are two tracks. When the border shelters or detention cells fill up, that's when they start sending children to some family shelters in other cities, while they find their parents or caretakers, and then they're released to parents usually. And a lot of them are coming to Miami because a lot of families from Central America live here. That's why there's a big flow of children. So some of the children are coming under government custody to some of these family shelters. And then they're coming to their parents directly from other government shelters in other cities to Miami.
Okay. And speaking of Miami, we have a call on the line. Mike is from Miami. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you? Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Do you have a question for us?
At the beginning, I mean, I've heard that they say these kids are coming in illegally, but in reality, there are other people from other countries that come in illegally, too, and they're permitted into this country. In reality, all this immigration coming to the U.S. is going to be good to us because it's going to be more economy, it's going to be more money coming in, and more jobs created. Right now, we have companies leaving the U.S. We got people, technicians living, going away from the U.S. But we got these people coming in here. It's going to be more money for the U.S., especially right now, the economy the way it is.
Thank you, Mike. On the subject of, Laura.
I just wanted to add, I mean, I didn't want to say that, the coyote is a good business, but I think what we often don't discuss while we're talking about these people coming is the extent to which these governments, it's not that this is happening in the night and they don't know what's happening. People who work for the government of these countries are fully involved. If the government had the money or the incentive to crack down, it could. The U.S., you know, the presidents are meeting today in Central America, and the question is, are we going to give them more aid to try to help the countries crack down, or do we give it to places like the Catholic Church or other churches or the UN, Central American groups, that will help A, handle these children when they go back, and B, also try to look for ways to stem the corruption that is facilitating this travel.
And Al, what is done for them once they do arrive? Who takes care of them? Where are they sheltered?
Well, I guess when they cross the border, the first agency that takes over, if they catch them, and I think they're catching most of them, if not all of them, is Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection. They put them in these detention cells. And I guess one thing that they children complain about is that they're very cold in those detention cells. In fact, they are known in Spanish as hieleras, because they're like ice boxes. Because the air conditioning is so high, and they don't have very thick blankets. And then after that, they're sent to these family shelters or shelters in other urban centers, and then another federal agency takes over. It's Health and Human Services, and within that, it's the Office of Refugee Resettlement that actually finds them a place to stay, usually with family members.
And one thing that's of concern with that is that right now they're using, you know, the Office of Refugee Resettlement funds for children who have yet to be designated as refugees officially, which is not necessarily a bad thing, except that when they are designated, where's that money going to be? Because they're spending it right now on these kids.
Except that the New York Times published a story today saying that they're already discussing a refugee program. I think
hopefully that will happen. But as we're saying, they're draining those funds right now.
And that puts these kids, these Central American kids, they're approaching this the same way that we handled the Vietnamese kids at the end of the Vietnam War, plus Haitian refugees. I mean, they're making it giving them refugee status is...
Not yet.
They're considering it.
Right.
Laura, Governor Rick Scott expressed some concern recently about the health of these kids. Now, what's that concern?
Well, there was an outbreak. I think it was of flu and chicken pox. I may be wrong at one of the naval bases where the kids are being held. I'm sorry, on this one, I have two toddlers, and we hit 101 fevers probably every few weeks in my house. They come home with foot and mouth from a pretty nice public school in Miami. And from, you know, private summer day camps. So, you know, these kids are they've been packed in rooms with hundreds of kids at a time. One girl told me she was sleeping on the floor with her baby. She's 16. She's fled with her three-year-old baby. And she was sleeping with in a room of some 400 people, almost 400, you know, no covers. They're going to get sick. I think they've stepped up the vaccines a little bit more, but the girls that I've talked to who've come recently, they weren't released until they had all their vaccines.
Yeah, and Health and Human Services said in a statement after the Florida press release went out that there's no cause for alarm.
Okay. And actually, the governor's concerns were evidently, Laura, you can correct me if I'm wrong, surprising to a couple of immigration advocates. We heard from one of them, Michelle Abarca. She's an attorney for Americans for Immigrant Justice.
I think South Florida is, in an ideal position to respond to part of this emergency. Our county is full of immigrants, many of them very successful people who know the struggle, and people who know that hard work and, you know, just staying in the right path can pay off. And I think that as a society in South Florida, that's the way we should respond.
Okay, now how strong an argument is that? We've got many, many immigrants in South Florida, so this is a perfect place for the kids.
Well, I guess there are many immigrants throughout the United States, so I guess in the overall scheme of things, it's something that is manageable. I don't see any major crisis of national proportions.
I mean, look, if I were a parent and suddenly had a ton of new kids coming to my school who needed a lot of extra services and the federal government or state is not providing them, I can understand frustration. Florida and Miami in particular has a strong history of receiving children from, you know, the Pedro Pan flights. Jacqueline can talk more about the crisis in Haiti, Central American wars, earthquakes. I mean, you name it, we've gotten people coming, the 94 boat crisis. So I think there are lessons to be learned here of what to do and what not to do. And in some ways, sort of Miami is used to having these floods of folks coming in, and we're not, you know, we don't freak out about it. We mm-hmm. kind of know, all right, another group's coming. We got to get ready.
Right. And if you've got a question for our panel, the number to call, once again, 800-743-WLRN. And on the subject of people who come here from other countries, make it their home, contribute to the community, turning now to the Haitian community, we're checking in with Jacqueline Charles. Jackie, good to have you in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Haitian President Michel Martelly came to South Florida last week. What was the purpose of the president's visit?
Well, the president actually was in town for personal reasons, but he made a cameo appearance during a town hall meeting that was organized by his prime minister, Laurent Lamothe, who is in charge of the government. And we had more than a dozen members of the Haitian government who were here to basically meet with the community. This is a town hall style meeting that they've done in Haiti a couple of times. And so they decided to bring it to South Florida, and it was televised, and it was interesting.
Interesting. I love the that turn of phrase, and I love the smile on your face as you're saying it. So what sort of reception did he get?
Well, you know, let's start with the president. The president came. Some of us knew that he was coming, but they pitched it as a surprised appearance. And at one point, he started talking about himself in the third person. And then he performed. He sang and he danced. And that picture made it on the front page of our local section. And,
okay, we need to do a little rewind and explain to our listeners exactly why the president of Haiti was singing and dancing.
Well, the president of Haiti used to be, before he became a politician, he was known as Sweet Mickey. And this was his base. He lived in Miami, and he performed at different venues around town. He performed compa, which is a little bit like soca, Caribbean music, Haitian rhythms. They call it the merengue. Similar to that. So he was very popular. He was like the Luther Campbell of Haitian music. And so in those brief moments when he was performing, the crowd was actually on their feet and they were enjoying it. And then at some point you realize, oh, but it's the president. I mean, he literally was grinding his waistline. And so depending on how people felt about that, not a lot of people were very happy about that.
But he did... While he was here, I do believe that he was reaching out to the diaspora, he did mention how much money goes from South,
exactly.
South Florida to Haiti.
The government has received a lot of flack for having this meeting in South Florida because the government is bleeding. It's financially broke. These guys were paid per diem per day for being here. There was airfare. There were, you know, hotel rooms. There were food. So a lot of people questioned whether or not this was the best use of Haiti's meager resources. But the president says, look, this community, the diaspora, provides $2 billion in Haiti. They're a significant part of the country's GDP. And even if it costs $50 million, that would not have been enough to spend in order to come here to the diaspora to reach out and basically to promote his government, promote his administration and what he's done.
Jackie, you were recently in Haiti with the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. Why was he there?
Well, it's interesting. Prior to UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon arriving in Haiti, I actually had an exclusive interview with him in New York in his office at the United Nations. And for the first time, really, he talked about cholera and in the context of the UN's moral responsibility, quote unquote. That was his quote, that the UN and the international community has a moral responsibility to help Haiti stop the spread of cholera. And that was significant because there are several lawsuits about this, and there's been a lot of blame to the UN for bringing cholera to Haiti 10 months after the earthquake in 2010. So, you know, here we are, and here he's saying this, and it's on the eve of his trip to Haiti. So he arrives in Haiti, he goes to a small remote village in the central part of the country, and he meets with a family that has really been impacted by cholera. And he was moved by that. After he came out of the house, he made some statements. But for some people, it's still not enough. But they would like for the UN to do much more. He's trying to help raise $2 billion for a 10-year mm-hmm. cholera elimination plan for Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
And Jackie, how many people have died so far?
So far, we've had more than 8,000 people have died from cholera and more than 600,000, actually more than 700,000 who've been infected by cholera. And the rates right now are pretty low. But what happens is that whenever it starts to rain, that's when you start to see the cases go up. And what everybody's looking for is whether or not we have the death. You know, people get sick, cholera is treatable, you just have to get to a facility, get liquids in you. But there's so many places that are remote, that are hidden, and it's very difficult.
Okay, one more question, then we got to take a break. So many things have hit Haiti in the recent years. It's just one thing after another. In brief, how are they doing?
Well, there has been progress post-earthquake. I mean, it's been 4 years. A lot of the rubble has been removed. A lot of people are no longer under tents. But the issue that you're looking at now is whether or not it's sustainable. When you think about 1.5 million people who are under tents, you think about the fact that 95% of them are no longer under tents, but the government has only really built about 3,000 houses. You have to ask yourself, where did those people go? So did they return to the same situation that they are in? Economically, financially, the country is not doing well. Foreign aid is going down because there's so many crises around the world. So it is a constant struggle, a battle to put this country afoot.
Jackie Charles with the Miami Herald, also Al Shardy with El Nuevo Herald. Always good to have you both in here. Thank you very much. Still to come, researchers want to school Governor Rick Scott in the science of climate change when we return. And welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. With tourism bringing billions of dollars into Florida every year, the health of the Sunshine State's beaches is critical to the health of our economy. And this week, there were several environmental stories that made headlines. In the studio with us again, boy, you get around, Laura Wise Munoz of the
Still here. You can't get rid of still me. Still here. Staying.
And Jenny Stiletovich, she covers the environment for the Miami Herald. Jenny. Good to have you in.
Thanks.
Now, Jenny, an environmental group is threatening to sue the Army Corps of Engineers over a dredging project in Miami. What happened here?
This is the same group that 2 years ago threatened to sue, or actually did sue, to try and ensure that the dredge did not damage the sea life, the coral, the seagrass around the dredge project. So once work started over the summer, just recently, in fact, one of the members of the group, who's a local fishing captain, encountered a large plume of sediment that the Corps was supposed to monitor and make sure it didn't spread. They felt like the Corps wasn't doing a good job of controlling it, so they threatened to file suit, which by law they have to notify the Corps that they're going to sue before they sue to give the Corps a chance to clean up. So they did that. The Corps has 60 days. Well, actually, it was last week, so you know, less than 60 days to address it, or else the Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper Group says they're going to go ahead and sue.
Okay, so this is all over the coral reefs.
It's the sediment affects the coral reef, but it also affects the seagrass, and the seagrass is like the ocean's nursery. You know,
yeah, we don't often hear about seagrass. We hear about the coral makes the news a lot, but very rarely seagrass. So explain again what seagrass
does.
Yeah,
it's all related. I mean, the coral are important because they're sort of like the first line of defense for storm surge. They act as like a barrier to the coast. They protect the coast. So if the coral erodes, you lose that layer of protection. The seagrass is there as a nursery for marine life. You get shrimp there, you get just a lot of, and you need the seagrass to support the kind of, you know, cycle of life.
Right, and my brother will kill me because my brother is a scuba diver and he will say, Chris, mention also that the coral is very pretty to look at.
Yeah,
we have a lot of scuba divers. So how does this lawsuit affect the dredge, the
well,
Miami project?
Well, it's not a lawsuit yet. As I said, the Corps has 60 days to remedy the problem, and if not, they'll proceed, you know, and it'll wind its way through court. I mean, the Corps can keep doing work. It depends on how the lawsuit is executed. I'm not a lawyer, but I suppose the Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper could ask for an injunction to stop the work. I'm not sure.
And we've also got Port Miami is not the only port in South Florida. We've got Port Everglades. We've got the Port of Palm Beach. Are there... How does this, if it does become a lawsuit, how would that affect the work being done at Port Everglades, which is the
closest? I don't think it would, because the Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper, that's why there are waterkeeper groups around the country. Their area of expertise is Biscayne Bay in this case. So whatever happens in the Port Everglades is not sort of their territory.
Okay. Well, it's not the only troubled water in South Florida. A recent federal report highlights that Florida is among the areas most vulnerable to sea level rise, to which Governor Rick Scott replied, quote, I'm not a scientist. And that remark has gotten a lot of flack. A group of researchers is offering to teach Governor Scott all about the science of sea level rise. One of them, Dr. Ben Kurtman. He's a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Miami.
The most important thing is to stop spreading doubt about climate change. Let's just acknowledge that the climate is changing. Then you can have a fair and honest policy debate about what to do about it.
Okay, so in South Florida, what are we doing about it?
Well, there's a lot of plans. You know, there's a lot of plans. This past week, Miami Beach decided to address its water and sewer system that is in part affected by sea rise. There are other organizations out there. There are task force that are intercounty, and Miami-Dade County has its own sea level rise task force that have come up with various plans. I don't think they've made it to the point that places like New York City, Mayor Bloomberg has a huge zillion-dollar plan, and so they're sort of working toward this goal. I think part of Professor Kurtman's point is that we should move beyond the debate, established, accepted as fact, so we can get going on the work that needs to be done. I mean, that's my interpretation of what he's saying.
Okay, switching gears a second, we've also been hearing this week that the Turkey Point nuclear power facility is in kind of hot water, literally, to employ a pun. What's the story with the cooling canals?
Recently, they've had algae in the cooling canal since 2011, but in recent weeks, that bloom has gotten out of control and clogged the cooling canals. This is a self-contained system of 168 miles of canals that basically move the water through the reactors to cool it and then back into the canals. That water has gotten increasingly hotter. The debate and at the important issue is what's happening with that water. The state just recognized that this water that has a higher... I'm sorry, I'm getting into the weeds of the technical stuff. But migrated and is causing saltwater intrusion inland. And that's the big issue that people want addressed and controlled.
Into the drinking water. It's affecting the drinking water?
It is affecting water in the aquifer. There's two aquifers. I mean, FPL would claim that it's not affecting drinking water. Environmentalists would say, you know, it is. It's approaching drinking water wells in the homestead area and the drinking water supply. So yeah, it's an issue. And a bigger issue too is when they approved the expansion of FPL and up, that was called the uprating, and put out 15% more energy. At the time, people worried that that was going to cause the temperature in the canals to go up. You can't cool a reactor with hot water in canals. FPL has recently asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to allow it to increase the temperature of those canals, because at now, federal law requires them to shut down the reactors if that water passes 100 degrees. In recent weeks, the water's averaged between 94 and 99 degrees. So they're kind of at a critical point where they need to get a handle on the algae blooms to get the water temperature down. They're hoping they can, you know, kind of manage it through the summer, and then when fall rolls around, it'll be cooler again. And they won't have to worry about the water temperatures. Environmentalists say, but there's climate change out there. You've got a utility that's increasing more power. That water is going to be hotter. Something needs a bigger plan needs to come into place. So,
okay. And also on the conservation front, you know, I've lived in South Florida for 18 years. I have never heard about the bonneted bat. It's evidently a famous Florida bat. And there's a fight going on over a contested piece of forest, and it involves Walmart and the University of Miami. Could you tell us about that? What's so special about this particular disputed parcel of land?
This piece of land is called Pine Rockland. It is part of what had been a 21-acre tract of land that was an old U.S. Navy blimp base, and the 40s, a hurricane came through, the blimp base closed down. The U.S. government started parceling out this land to various entities. UM got a big tract, the county got land for the zoo, the Coast Guard owns land down there. Over the years, it was largely undeveloped, and this endangered pine rockland, which used to stretch from Homestead to the Miami River on the kind of the spiny ridge of Florida, the highland, has dwindled to 2%. It is considered among the most imperiled forests on the planet. It's like the Madagascar of Miami. And besides the bonneted bat, it is the habitat for a various species that are found no place else.
Name a few.
Bartram's hair streak butterfly, which is scheduled to be listed on the endangered species list this summer. The Florida leafwing butterfly, another butterfly that's up for listing. There's something called the rimrock crown snake that's only been seen 20 times in recorded history. And
who protects this sounds like a very important parcel of land for wildlife. Who protects this?
Well, there are various protections. There are state, there are federal, and there are local. And that's kind of what's being hammered out now. The Walmart property, the reason the environmentalists got so upset is because it kind of snuck in under the radar. Originally, when the land was rezoned by UM, it was supposed to be an academic village. At the time, the environmentalists who I've talked to said they objected to it. They lost that battle. They thought it was a done deal and that it was going to be an academic village. And then, they turn around last week and suddenly there is a Walmart that's going to be built as part of this strip shopping center, an apartment complex on this parcel of land next to the zoo.
And what happened to the academic complex, the university complex?
I think it was a funding issue. I'm not really sure. Those plans just kind of, I don't know what happened to those plans, but they fell through, and the university started negotiating with developers for something else, and the something else was this shopping center and apartment complex.
So what are the potential outcomes here of this battle?
Well, there's some environmental groups that are taking a close look and considering, they tell me, potential legal action. U.S. Fish and Wildlife had a meeting this week with the developer. The developer has agreed to turn over the plans for the project so Fish and Wildlife can take a closer look and see if there's something that can be done to protect more of the forest. The part of the problem, too, is the plans were based on a survey of endangered lands that was 10 years old, and biologists and botanists who were invited out to the land after the plans were approved to do a rescue mission for endangered plants found just a trove of plants and endangered animals outside the preserve areas, and they say the best land is not in the land being set aside for the preserve, but in land that's slotted for development. And so U.S. Fish and Wildlife is trying to maybe come up with a deal with the developer to save some of that land.
Jenny Stiletovich, she covers the environment for the Miami Herald, a very, very important beat. Jenny, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, please call us. You can join in this conversation. We're waiting for you. The number to call is 800-743-WLRN. Jenny's just told us about the beautiful natural places. There are other beautiful places that tourists come to, and certainly places we year-round dwellers like to take them to once they arrive. And this week, unfortunately, we lost one of them, right, Wilson?
Yeah,
Wilson Sayers with us, a legendary eatery. Now, Jumbo's in Miami's Liberty City has been around longer than most of us in this room anyway have been alive, okay? And Wilson, you covered the closing of Jumbo's, and a lot of restaurants closed down. I mean, it's a sad fact of life, but why was this closing so significant?
Well, there's several reasons, but I want to start off by talking about the owner. He has himself been an institution in this community, not only because of the restaurant. Bobby Flam, I talked with him earlier this week.
Jumbo's is a place where I've been since 1955, since I'm 10 years old. I bought the restaurant from my dad. I've been running Jumbo's since then, 47 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's part of my life, it's part of my legacy, it's part of my history.
So in 1967, Bobby Flam, who has almost every hour since opening had this restaurant, he decided to buck what he called an uncivilized tradition and integrate the workforce there. It was a bold move back in 1967. Mm-hmm. And so in this community that's predominantly black. This is like a bold move, and he is a white business owner, and so this is a way to open his arms to the community, and the community has opened its arms to him for almost 60 years now.
So what happened? Why did it have to close?
Well, I think over the many years that it has been open, it slowly deteriorated. One of the things that Bobby Flam points out is that there's been a pretty negative perception of the area starting in the 1980s when the riots went through after a black man was killed by police officers and were acquitted of that beating. And so there was a negative perception. Hurricane Wilma came through and kind of battered the restaurant. He wasn't able to really afford the fixes that he wanted to put in. So it's kind of been these piecemeal repairs, and just it hasn't really been the glowing place that it used to be. And so people started not coming. Some people said the food went downhill. He says, of course, the food has always been perfect.
Okay, what I really want to know is, you know, what did you eat when you visited?
Well, we went out on Wednesday, on the last day that it was open, and much like apparently it used to be, the line was out the door and we were not able to sit down. But it was great hearing some of the people get on the karaoke machine that they've had for a couple years and talk about their stories of Jumbo's back in the day.
Okay, Jumbo's, we will surely miss you. Farewell. But, you know, we do have cause to celebrate. Shuckers is back.
Woo-hoo. Shuckers
reopened. North Bay Village Bar and Grill reopened after a frightful incident. The deck collapsed last summer, but it's back. And according to the owners, it's a much safer place. New deck is steel reinforced and all that jazz.
Oh, yeah. Steel reinforced above what is required for the type of deck that it is. It's a deck on top of a concrete deck. And so, I mean, the city helped them get the permits perhaps faster than they otherwise would have been. It's just it's a community center in North Bay Village, and a lot of people were really, really excited to have their spot back.
The cheers of North Bay Village.
So a fond farewell to Jumbo's. Welcome back, Shuckers. And that is all the time that we have left for today's Florida Roundup for Friday, July 25th, 2014. And a very, very big thank you to all our guests today. Laura Weitz-Munoz from the Associated Press, Mary Shedden from WUSF, Al Shardy from El Nuevo Herald, Jenny Stiletovich from Miami Herald, Jackie Charles, also Miami Herald, Wilson Sayre, our very own WLRN reporter Wilson Sayre. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or we'll post it on our website. That's WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Steph Farrow and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mayers. Our tech supervisor, Paul Leary, the man behind the glass over there smiling at me. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Christine DiMattei. Thanks so much for listening.